This is Central Time. Now it's time for a regular check-in on the latest science news with Discover Magazine. A recent discovery of multiple Tyrannosaurus fossils could shatter the long-held belief that the creatures were solitary hunters. We'll learn more about the find and what it could mean for what we know about dinosaurs. Plus, new research shows that while people love their screen time, they're still pretty interested in nature, and we'll find out how humans' ability to adapt led us to become the world's dominant species. Anna Groves is with us, assistant editor at Discover Magazine. Anna, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, Anna, there's this T-Rex story that I want to start with, because you know, you think of one T-Rex chasing you around in Jurassic Park, that's bad. Think of three or four of them working together, that's really bad. Before we get to this new find, what do we think we know, or what had we thought we knew about how a T-Rex might have hunted and how social it was?
Well, the old story was that, I mean, just like you described, what you picture in Jurassic Park is that a T-Rex would have been a solitary predator working alone. A lot of paleontologists thought that they probably weren't even smart enough to have any social relationships or social structure.
And what are we finding now that, you know, this is not for sure, but what are we finding now that might change that story?
Right. It's not for sure, but there was a group of Tyrannosaurus fossils that were found in Utah a couple years ago that really looked like it was a family unit. It was an adult Tyrannosaurus, a teenager, and two juveniles. And that really suggested, like, these Tyrannosauruses might have been hanging out in a family unit, and it caused a lot of paleontologists to sort of rethink how we thought Tyrannosauruses hung out.
And the researcher behind that find, part of that team, is definitely buying into this idea that, hey, maybe the T-Rex was more social and maybe thus more intelligent than we thought. Can you talk about the argument that he and some others are making?
Yeah, well, just the fact that they that the fossils were found in a group suggests that there might have been some sort of social structure in these groups. And others are even coming in and saying that maybe they could have been hunting in groups, in packs. This makes a lot of sense if you think about, like, how other pack animals work. Like, if it takes a herd of, or excuse me, if it takes a pack of wolves to take down an elk, like, why wouldn't it take a pack of T-Rexes to take down some sort of dinosaur or herbivore that was traveling in herds? So a lot of it is just speculation at the time, but they're hopeful that there's going to be more fossil groups like this found in the future that'll sort of give more clarity to the issue.
And we have thought all along that we don't think of reptiles in general, I guess, as being social hunters, pack hunters, right? I mean, I don't know all the reptiles out there. I can't think of any that would hunt in packs, but that's part of why we thought this about dinosaurs, right?
Right, and apparently some researchers are coming out and reminding us that there are even some reptiles that exhibit a little bit more social behaviors than we might have thought. Apparently there's some crocodilians that will, like, play with each other.
And also some there was some thought that reptiles, well, maybe they weren't just going to have the brain power. Is this just kind of a like a pro-mammal bias maybe playing into this?
Right, exactly.
What
people are definitely biased towards mammals. They think, I mean, we assume that most or all mammals will be smarter than reptiles.
So the next step, I guess, would be trying to find more groups of T-Rex fossils that happen end up together, which doesn't sound like a sure thing, that even if they did hunt together, we might not find them that way.
Right, right. Because to find the group of fossils together requires that they also died together, which is sort of a weird fluke event. Like this particular group of fossils, they're wondering if maybe there was a flash flood or something that would have drowned all of them all at once.
I want to turn to another story. You wrote about some research that appeared in the journal Nature, I believe it was, on screen time, the internet, and nature. A lot of assumptions are that, okay, if we're spending more time on screens, it means we're not interested in what's going on in the world of nature, but maybe not. What did you look at?
Yeah, so this paper was out in PLOS Biology, actually, and it was by a conservation biologist who sort of dabbled in data science to do this cool study where he looked at 2 billion page views from Wikipedia species pages. And he was actually doing a different project, and just sort of on a whim, he was like, well, I wonder if I plot these page views over time, if there will be any trends. And so he picked He just happened to pick a seasonal, like a migratory bird that's seasonal in its appearance in the U.S., and the page views perfectly matched the migration patterns of the birds, meaning people were reading the page interested about this bird during the time of year that that bird was around.
And then he went on with this and looked at other species, right, and tried to see if non-migratory birds had different patterns, if a bird like a turkey might peak on one day of the year. What kind of things did he say?
Yeah, so the non-migratory species, things like chickadees and cardinals that live in the U.S. year-round, they still had a little bit of fluctuations, but not nearly as much as the migratory birds that you literally can't see in the summertime, or in the wintertime, excuse me. So there were some really cool patterns there, like cardinals were pretty consistent year-round in how often people were reading the Wikipedia page about cardinals. Turkeys were a really funny one. They did show some seasonal fluctuations. They peaked in their page views how many people are reading about wild turkeys in the springtime. But their biggest peak, of course, is this little blip on Thanksgiving Day. Everyone's reading about the wild turkey.
So it sounds like people, in some cases, use the internet in the way that I, you know, after I watch a movie, I'll go look up all the actors on IMDb and try to figure out where I saw them before. We do the same thing with nature. We see the bird pop up or we hear about it popping up, and we supplement our interest in nature by hunting around online at that time.
Yeah, it was just a really encouraging finding because it shows that people are still paying attention to what they're seeing outside.
We're talking to Anna Gross from Discover Magazine, taking a look at some of the most intriguing stories in the world of science. Coming up, we'll continue our science news check-in and look at the adaptability of humans and how it affected our evolution. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our science news roundup with Anna Grove. She's an assistant editor at Discover Magazine. Anna, let's take a look now at human evolution. There's a piece in the April edition of Discover that looks at how we humans kind of took over the globe. And it's all about, we have kind of a unique kind of adaptability, right? What's going on?
Yeah, so a lot of animals you think of as being either generalist or specialist. So a generalist, of course, is something like a raccoon that can live in lots of different places, eat lots of different foods. And then you have specialists, which is things like a koala bear that eats only eucalyptus. So there's new research out that suggests that maybe the reason why humans are so good at living everywhere is because we can be both. We can both generalize and live everywhere. But also, a lot of new research is coming out to show that different groups are actually specialized and adapted to where they live.
Now, I hear that, and my first thought would be, oh, yeah, it's culture. We adapt by, you know, learning how to wear coats in the extreme cold climates and use certain tools in other climates. But no, we also, it looks like, physically adapt to this wide variety of climates and habitats, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's exactly what I thought, too. So one of the cool examples of this is the people who live at high elevation. So there's a lot of reasons why living at high elevation is hard. It's usually cold. It's usually dry. You're closer to the sun, so you get a lot of UV radiation. But apparently the biggest thing is that the oxygen is low in the air. But apparently there's 80 million people worldwide that live above the threshold for, like, comfortable oxygen levels called the hypoxia threshold. So what these researchers have found is that some of these populations, like people living high in Tibet, actually have genetic changes that show that they have adapted to this low oxygen environment. They're not just acclimated.
Which is pretty amazing. I think I would never acclimate to that kind of environment based on limited experience at high altitudes anyway. And does this mean what we evolve quickly? We, over the course of a few generations, have these adaptations?
Well, I don't know how quickly it's happening. I'm thinking it's taken a lot longer than just a few generations.
Okay,
but
I was exaggerating.
But yes, over time, I don't want to put a timetable on it, but over many, many generations, people would adapt to these different extreme environments.
And it looks like, compared to some of our early ancestors, our early cousins in the development of what we think of now as modern humans, we were unique even among that group. Do I have that right?
Yeah, so this is actually what the new research is mostly talking about is that maybe this adaptability is why our species, Homo sapiens, outlived the other early humans like Homo erectus.
Right, because they were, if I remember my early science correctly, they were starting to use tools and things like that, like modern humans do. But maybe they didn't have that adaptability, that physical adaptability that we had.
Yeah. It seems like more and more research is showing that those species really just stuck to the same sorts of habitats, and they didn't branch out like Homo sapiens did.
Interesting. And I want to take a look at one more thing. The 20 Things You Didn't Know article this week is about seasons. Why do we have seasons on Earth? It sounds like there may have been a big collision involved in how our seasons work.
Yeah. So apparently, first of all, the reason why we have seasons is because the Earth is tilted a little bit on its axis. It's not straight up and down like a spinning top. But a lot of astronomers believe that about 4.5 billion years ago, something probably the size of Mars knocked into Earth and turned it on its side a little bit.
That's a frightening thought.
Yeah, right? I hope that doesn't happen again.
Right. And so it's that tilt that gives us the seasons. And I've heard people incorrectly, it turns out, think that, okay, the Earth moves closer and further from the sun. That much is true. It does. We're kind of at this, like, elliptical orbit. But they think, okay, we're closer to the sun, it's summer. We're further from the sun, it's winter. That's not it.
Right. Since the orbit isn't a perfect circle, a lot of people think that, like, well, of course, when we're closer to the sun, that's going to make it hotter. But that would affect the whole Earth, not just like one hemisphere at a time. So it's really the tilt that means when it's summer in Wisconsin, it's winter in Australia.
And then the piece looks into how some animal species have adapted to the seasons. You know, some of us humans have adapted by watching Netflix and eating cookies indoors until it's finally spring here in Wisconsin. How about non-human species? What do they do?
Yeah, so we know the most about animals that migrate across land. That's sort of the most common example. But there's also marine mammals that migrate up and down in the water column as the seasons change. So they're following oxygen levels that vary with the seasons.
And, of course, then there's the hibernating animals, or the ones that go into a dormant state, even if it's not technically hibernation, right?
Yeah. So we know the obvious hibernators like bears, but there's a similar a similar thing that happens with a lungfish is a cool example. And a lungfish lives in a freshwater environment, but it dries up completely during the dry season. But instead of moving, the lungfish just burrows underground to look for moisture. And so that's called estivating instead of hibernating.
And Anna, as we wrap up, anything have you excited about the change of seasons and spring coming along?
Oh, my gosh. I'm counting down the days until we peak 40.
All right. Anna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Anna Groves, assistant editor at Discover Magazine, which is based in Waukesha. She joined us today for a monthly check-in on some of the coolest science news.